The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take a ride through.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp, number 106. Today, we have the proud, the few, the Thomas Kiernak, all the way from Slovakia.
Hello, hello.
Hey, bud. So let's see what's cooking. Let's get the vegetables out of the way. We have three new patrons. Patrons. They're patrons. They go to Patreon, but they are patrons. That is Trevor Spence, Greg Lipschitz. He's from Australia. We got another Australian. They're starting to outpace the American members. They're starting to really grow in speed. This guy is from Southern Australia, I think. I think that's where Andrew is.
Are you saying your advanced prediction model is shoving Australians overtaking the Americans?
That's why we got to build these walls, bud.
These jokers out.
And then
I mean they're fairly well contained in their own island, you know. It's
I was having a conversation with, can you really call Australia an island when it's like bigger than the United States?
I think it's bigger than really any other country. Maybe Canada. I think it's bigger than Russia though.
Aren't we all just islands? I don't know. It doesn't feel like an island. It feels too big to be an island.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
There's not that many people there, though, so maybe you can't call it an island. I don't know. The whole middle of it's uninhabitable, so really, if you just kind of look at the ring that actually people live in, maybe. Anyway, I digress. We also have Rob Daltonian. I probably butchered that. Daltonian. I think that's right. So those guys became patrons. You go to patreon.com/brotherswisp. You sign up and you get access to the members only Slack. And those guys have already started participating, except for Rob. I think he just signed up today, or maybe I just sent it to him this morning, something like that. So thank you guys for joining in. Speaking of patronage, we are also sponsored by Sonar. And that is sonar.software. It's a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. You can easily learn more at sonar.software. So let's see what else we got cooking. I've been hearing, this isn't the first time either, but Call of Duty keeps slaughtering the internet. You know, everybody was talking about Kim Kardashian breaking the internet. It turns out it's really Call of Duty in their updates. They keep releasing. I mean, they're like multi-gig updates, right? Like 16 gigs or something, this last one?
This one was, I think, 60 gigs.
Oh, 60? I thought it was 16. Yeah. 6-0.
So, supposedly, the update was 60 gigabytes because they are optimizing the game for future upgrades to be smaller, supposedly. Whether that's actually true and how much value there is in that, I suppose we'll see.
That's crazy. Yeah, we're seeing like TalkTalk. It's a ISP over in the UK. They were saying that they saw, I think, a record spike of 5.4. Attack
what
cat.
What is this cat doing?
Oh, it's going bananas, dude. 5.43 terabits per second. The cat is just mad, man, because cats used to, I mean, they ran the internet. Now they're being dethroned by video games. So it's insane. Yeah. I've seen a couple of media posts about ISP saying that these video games keep murdering their networks. That, like, somebody was saying, yeah, we lost most of our VoIP quality for half a day because of video game updates. So it's pretty nuts. I think Miller was saying that they saw record numbers coming off that Call of Duty update as well on their network.
There was a really interesting Reddit thread where people discussed, you know, just how much additional throughput they were getting throughout the update, and like the consensus in the Reddit thread was that most ISPs were seeing anywhere from 40% to 70% increased throughput during the updates, which is and this is at peak times, so compared to their peak, you know, it's additional 40% to additional 70% traffic, which is
bananas, man.
Also, Akamai hit a new record. So from all their edge locations for the update, Akamai clocked in at 140 terabytes per second during the update. So
I mean, that's almost unfathomable.
It's unimaginable traffic, really, for a normal person, for a normal network. 140 terabytes, you know, how do you even visualize, or how do you even understand what it takes to push that amount of traffic?
That's like when we're talking about the US budget of like multiple trillion dollars. It's like, how does that, you know, I mean, you might as well just be making up words at this point. It's such a, you know, huge number. I can't even wrap my brain around it.
Yeah, it's scales you just normally don't deal with, and therefore you don't even understand. So
they just need to go back to mailing out CDs to people.
Yeah, sure.
I was listening to somebody talk about just how things have shifted, because like video game developers, I mean, your game, when it came on a cart, that was it, right? If there were bugs, if there were anything in there, you know, that was it. You had one shot at it, and now...
Depends if you were a PC gamer or some console scrub.
If you had a Super Nintendo, the thing that came in the cart was what you got. And they were talking about nowadays, sometimes you'll get a game and day of release, there's updates that you have to pull and things like that.
Yeah, it's common now for there to be basically a day zero, you know, 15, 20 gig patches. And if you go to a game shop or, you know, any of those dying brick and mortar game stores, these days you buy a game and instead of a disc, there is just an activation code in there, you know. So even hard copies are not really hard copies anymore. It's just activation keys for download. So yeah, everything's it's changed.
Yeah, for sure. Nature of the beast, the way things move. It's just I don't know, it's odd. I mean, it makes sense for like, especially for like indie game developers, because they're smaller, they have smaller teams. I mean, it's far less likely they're going to be able to catch all of the issues with their games and stuff. So I can definitely see those zero-day updates, you know. But like AAA titles, man, it's like, I guess, you know, those guys are under the same constraints, right? Their stuff's probably getting rushed out. Games are getting more massive. Environments are more complex.
It just depends. You have developers today, which is, I'm talking mostly about EA and Activision Blizzard, who have just completely screwed up basically just about every major release they have done lately, right? If you look at the release of Warcraft 3 Reforged from Activision Blizzard, that was a complete crap show. And if people want a really good internet drama, go and look into how the release of Warcraft 3 Reforged went. And, you know, then you have all the Call of Duties, and then you have all the EA stuff that's been getting hated on massively recently as well. It's... I don't know, the big game development corporations are just... The quality has gone out the window instead of quantity, which is, as you can imagine, not a very good sign. Somehow Nintendo is actually doing a good job, which congrats to them. So the entire situation in the industry has been shifting and very much changing over the last years, and like studios which were associated with quality previously, aka Blizzard, right, are now completely screwing up for multiple different reasons on multiple fronts after acquisitions from Activision. But it's a topic unto itself, and the industry is, of course, constantly changing, and yeah, distribution methods and these huge updates come hand in hand with that. So,
you know, it's funny, something you said kind of... reminded me of something completely different. I guess things are starting to kind of meld together, is that your entertainment, your media, right? A lot of people have video game franchises that they love and follow, and the first game, maybe the first sequel to it are really awesome, and then, you know, quality starts to wane. You know, they farm it out to other studios, you know, as their, you know, their workload goes up and stuff like this. And it's not unlike movie franchises, right? Like Star Wars. Like some people, you know, they love the first three, and then after that, nothing existed for a good chunk of time, you know. So it's just, I think people, when they fall in love with a franchise as much as they do, like Star Wars or kind of these Call of Duty sort of games, you just get so invested in it that, you know, if anything strays from the formula, if it doesn't feel true to itself, it doesn't make you feel the way it did the first time you watched that movie, you've got complaints, and now you've got a platform to air all those complaints on, right?
Yeah, and it goes like you can find examples for this everywhere, you know, Game of Thrones, or even look at the latest season of Expanse after Syfy sold it to Amazon, right? Expanse was probably one of my favorite, not probably, very likely my favorite sci-fi TV show, simply because it was almost completely based, or as close based on the realistic physics as they could get it for, you know, a TV show. Of course, there are sci-fi elements and everything else, but I would argue it's the closest to realistic physics any sci-fi franchise has ever come, right? But the latest season, I feel, wasn't at all in the spirit of the previous seasons after Amazon bought it of sci-fi, right? It was very different, and I suppose there's no point getting into all of that, but like you can find examples of things just decreasing in quality as time goes on. Like you look even at things like Simpsons, or you know, first three seasons are supremely highly rated, and then if you look at the ratings of Simpsons episodes, it's just a downhill slope from there, right? And it's, yeah, just, you know, casts change, directors change, writers change, there is purchases and acquisitions, and meanwhile, quality suffers.
Yeah, well, I think too, you as a person change, right? Your wants, your desires, the things you like, the things you don't like, those things change over time. Just like anything else. So maybe that has something to do with it as well.
I don't know, maybe.
And I think too,
I think a TV show or a movie being stupid is just bad decisions in the writers and, you know, executives of big corporations, but you know.
You know what I've found in this new world of binge media that we have is that I get fatigue after a while. You know, if there I find a new show that I really like it at first, and there's 13 seasons, and then they have these little extra special seasons. I mean, I'm really into it, and then I get season two, it's great, and then three, and then eventually I just start getting tired. You know, just even if the media, even if season four is just as good as season one, it's just something about you know, as many episodes as we generally starting to get in these, just whatever these shows are. Man, I'm just getting worn out. I just get burned out. I just need to cleanse my palate for a little while. Maybe that's, you know, maybe I need to come up with a, you know, season, and then I need a break at least for like 2 weeks, and then season,
Yeah.
and, you know, just to keep myself from getting worn out.
I think it's like, you know, anything new is super exciting. So as soon as you find anything that you haven't seen before that just, you know, stimulates your brain the right way because it's something you haven't ever seen, or it's ideas or concepts you have never before even thought about, you know, that is super exciting. But as soon as you get used to that luxury, as with anything, you know, it's super easy to get used to good things, but once you are used to them, you know, they're not as cool as it anymore.
Do you ever find like a new song that you really like, so you make sure you don't listen to it for like a few days, and you listen to it once or twice, and then you wait a little bit?
I
You
try to pace myself, yeah.
don't want to burn it out. Oh
Yeah.
man, I don't know. It's a different world where, you know, I just used to be so hungry for stuff, you know, because I couldn't pick and choose what I got when I wanted, and now everything is right there when I want it, and yeah,
I
I
like
can
it
just
that
I
way
get worn
though.
out.
I personally like it that way though.
I do too,
I
to a
have
degree.
so for example, I haven't owned a TV in about 10 years, I think. I hate TV. It's completely wasted time for me. It's, yeah, 10 years now I haven't had a TV, and I hopefully never will again. But it's just as an example of, you know, programming gets shuffled down your throat. You have no choice of what you are watching. You are wasting time channel surfing, and like 25% of the time you are watching it's ads anyway, and it's like it's completely horrible.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. I can still remember being a kid, and you know, it'd be like Thanksgiving or something, and the TV's on in the background, and I don't know. It was just kind of like this constant fixture, and it's weird. I mean, just like a home phone used to be a constant fixture, and now that's gone. Just thinking how I'm not nostalgic for it necessarily. Just thinking about like my kids these days. You know, they'll never know that. You know, because we don't have regular television either. We just have like Hulu and Netflix, and you know, they use YouTube or whatever. So they are still very familiar with commercials. Anybody with YouTube is very familiar with commercials, but it's just, I don't know, it's
Just use
different.
Adblock.
Well, that's an interesting little rabbit hole we just walked down.
Yeah, definitely. Wait, what is this podcast about again?
Oh, we started at video games. All right, let's talk about some networking stuff. Let's see. I'm going to mention it here, but I don't have a lot of details. But there is a lot of scuttlebutt I've seen in the Slack and on Facebook in various groups about buy sells and CBRS. I guess they just now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they just now made some kind of a press release. Well, I say just now, like within the last few days, I guess, saying that now that CBRS is actually about to be available to people, that Generation 1 CPEs aren't going to support it. So, as somebody said, early adopters are getting boned. That's a nice way of saying it. So with no recourse, I guess there's no offer to make it right, so, no make amends, but
There's multiple angles to this. Sorry about that. So it's both Bicels and Telrad, apparently.
Oh, them as well, huh?
Sorry if I'm mistaken there, then, you know, blaming Telrad for something. But as far as I understand, it's both Bicels and Telrad. And there might be other vendors being affected as well.
So
maybe.
You think it was the Gen 1 hardware that they both used in the CPEs?
So, that's the hard question. So maybe start from the beginning. There is a whole lot of flame wars going on in various places right now regarding this. People are extremely pissed off because there is a lot of money involved.
Yeah.
Right. You have people who have deployed hundreds of these units with promises that going forward they will support CBRS.
Yeah, I mean the idea was you're future-proofing your investment.
Yeah, exactly. So you were supposed to be future-proofing, and now, and I think the funniest debate that I was laughing at on Facebook was, you know, somebody was saying these are not cheap, and then somebody else was saying, oh, but these are the cheapest CBRS gear, and you know, but yeah, that still doesn't make them cheap. And then there was a huge flame war about, you know, what does cheap even mean? You know, do you compare cheap to other CBRS gear? In which case, you know, Bicels is cheap, but then again, if you compare it in like actual factual value in dollars, it's not cheap, right? So it's like people were flame warring, even, you know, what do you expect? You buy the cheapest gear, and you know, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
Well, comparatively, it is, but you know. To get back to that, so yeah, there is a lot of flame warring, and there is a lot of heated discussion everywhere going happening. There is a lot of money involved for people. If you imagine, you know, you have 100, 200, 400 of these units out there in the field, and now you need to swap them. That's a forget that you need to buy new CPEs. You know, mm-hmm. All those truck rolls and time and loss in company image and everything that goes with it, it's huge. Like, potentially, this is Hello Cat. You know, potentially this is a lot of money in basically in you are losing, right? And so that's one angle why people are angry. But that angle could be mitigated if this was handled better from a PR perspective by these companies. So specifically, Bicels has had no official statement, has contributed no explanations to why, has offered no plan, you know, what will be happening or what they are doing. And it's just the silence from Bicels is pissing people off even more, which is, I think, understandable. You know, silence and will bring in all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories and all kinds of crazy, you know, why this isn't supported. There are theories, you know, maybe the CPU isn't strong enough, the hardware isn't good enough, or maybe it's just financially not viable.
Yeah.
I find this super funny for those that don't follow.
If you don't come out and speak your truth, other people are going to make it up for you, you know, because that's all they have to do is speculate. So.
Yeah, exactly. If there is no official statement, it will be speculation. But the funny one, which I also got a good laugh at, there is now a community fund. So people are gathering money, if it is a financial issue, to actually donate to Bicels to fix it. Because people would rather pay extra money, or it will still be cheaper in the end to pay extra money to make it financially viable for Bicels to fix it, rather than truck roll and replace all of these units. So, like, there is even, you know, community fundraising organizers starting to organize now to pay themselves to, you know, if this is not financially viable, to still make it.
That's a clever idea. You know, if it would cost you a fraction of the price of doing all that.
But still, you know, it's crazy how much basically speculation and plans and ideas and hate and flame wars and everything else is happening in the community just because Bisols couldn't handle their PR, right? So yeah, updates to follow, I suppose.
I mean, this couldn't have just surprised them out of nowhere, right? They had to have seen this coming for a little while, you would think, right?
I am not an expert.
Yeah, I'm not either.
In this entire field, because CBRS doesn't affect me in any way, Mike would probably know much more about this. But basically, the CBRS rules were not fully formalized and finished by the FCC up until, I think, a couple of months ago, right? So these companies were manufacturing equipment which was future-proofing for something that wasn't yet fully specified and fully finished. And now, you know, other people and a side of the argument is that, you know, well, you should be angry at the FCC for not taking the Gen 1 gear and hardware into consideration for the final CBRS rules, right? So that's an angle as well, which is...
Yeah.
You could debate if that's a valid angle or not, but so yeah, they really didn't know for years that this would not be supported. They know now it will not be supported due to the final FCC specifications of CBRS, but still there is no official statement of why. So, you know, all we can do is speculate.
Right. Is it hardware? Is it software? Is CPU? It money? Yeah. I mean, because I think they came out with some additional stuff, right? Where like each... And I'm talking out of my butt. Like, I think each CPE has to, like, give its GPS coordinates back to the controller, and that has to
GPS be, like... is not officially required for CBRS.
Oh, excellent. Because I remember they were talking about some stuff like that at one point.
There is, of course, certification and everything else, you know, and that's also a part of the debate, you know, is it just a certification issue? There is, but yeah, GPS is not officially required.
All right, well, that's good. All right, so that's a can of worms that I guess is being slowly... cranked open right now, and I'm assuming by the time we do one in 2 weeks, there'll probably be some decent information out on it.
I don't know. Well, hopefully, if Bisols manages to put out a decent statement of what's happening right now, they are just getting slaughtered by just about everyone.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. If you don't supply some information, fear sets in, and people, you know, people get afraid, they get irrational. So,
I think, there is Wisp America coming real soon, and I think Bisols has a stand, so they might get some real angry visitors there unless they do something about
this. No kidding, dude. I think it's like a month away. Oh, man, I hope I hope the salespeople are wearing bulletproof vests while they're
up. Yep.
Oh, man, they're going to be getting their asses handed to them. Oh, that's tough. That's tough. I didn't even think about that. That's going to be real tough. All right, maybe we can... maybe we can hopefully get some kind of information out beforehand. Otherwise, oh, man, feeding those lambs to the slaughter. That would be awful. Let's see. Let's let that one lie for a little bit. Miller found a CLI version of speedtest.net. Do you guys use speedtest? I know, like, over at the ISP you guys used to run. Was that something that customers do? Because everybody here goes to speedtest.net.
Same here. There used to be a local Slovakian site years ago, dsl.sk, that people would use, but these days it's all just speedtest.
Hmm. So I think you can run it from like a Linux machine, Mac, Ubuntu, Fedora, CentOS, FreeBSD, all that stuff. I think they even have like a Windows version. So you can pretty much run it on anything, CLI version.
Yeah, super useful.
Nice, nice, nice. So for you guys that haven't seen it, go take a look. Let's see. Several people have been reporting problems out of Chrome 80. And I think Mike Niddle said he fixed some of his problems by pulling down the self-signed cert off of some of the pages that weren't loading and then loading them into a store. And that sort of worked around. I think I heard some people saying that they just downgraded a 79 or whatever. I'm not 100% on that, but if you have stuff start bricking, maybe take a look at that.
I would not recommend importing certs into trust stores of operating systems as a long-term solution.
Right.
Sure, you can use it as a workaround, but not a good idea as a long-term solution. Downgrading...
What do you think? Use Firefox then?
I am not sure what to do with this one. Luckily, I haven't been affected yet. Like all of the... On my work Linux system, I use Firefox, not Chrome. And so far with all the updates to Firefox, there hasn't been anything that's broken, and I use a lot of stupid stuff, like old, you know, flash-based UIs and, you know, ILOs and IPMIs and vCenter and ESXi frontends, which are just, you know, stupid stuff. But so far, it hasn't affected me yet, so I don't have any specifics.
Sweet action. Yeah, I don't have a dog in that fight. I don't have anything that's broken yet, so I'm still doing good. Let's see. Some other people were talking about. Some guy was. I can't even remember who. I like shouting out their name. But they were saying that they had a run that was hit by a snowplow, like a copper run. So he had to rig a connection together. And I was thinking, what do I normally do? You know, it's like if it's inclement weather, if for whatever reason you just can't replace that cable right now, what I usually do is I crimp ends on there, and then I put a regular off-the-shelf coupler on it. I wrap it in electrical tape, and then I'll slather it with liquid electrical tape, or I'll put silicone all over the top of it. It's going to look like hammered shit, but it generally keeps the water out and keeps it up long enough for me to replace it, or long enough for me to forget about it, and then it'll just continue to run in perpetuity. What do you usually do for stuff like that? You know, like emergency, like real emergency, where you just got to rig it back together.
It depends what situation is it in. We once had a car run down a pole where our fiber was. And so, of course, the fiber was pulled with all the other electrical and other wires through the poles. And actually, the car, when it pulled down one pole, it like bent the entire, like, I think, six poles that were connected to it. You know, that was the force of impact that it actually pulled and bent everything. And of course, it tore our fiber. And this was in the middle of the city. And, you know, what can you do there? Not much other than repair the fiber.
Right.
But if it's a copper cut, those are definitely much easier. But also, so sometimes we fix them. But if it's possible, we would, rather than hacking something together, we would usually put up just wireless bridges in the meantime. Like today, especially with the Microtech 60 gig, it's super easy to replace any, you know, if it's possible, at least, it, like if it's inside of some property that you are running through and there's a cut and you can, you know, place a 60 gig bridge from one side to the other, that would be my preferred option rather than hacking it together. But, you know, it just depends on the situation.
Yeah, for sure. You want to do it right, you don't want to do it dirty.
That's my philosophy, yeah.
I'd rather do it dirty and then let somebody else fix it when the time is right. That's what we do. We'll usually rig something back together, and then we'll get our cable guy to come out and rerun something, and then we'll do it in a window. Because we've got like a policy where we generally try and do like a week's notice for any maintenance or stuff like that. So, you know, if we can kind of fudge it back together really quick and then do the actual week's notice and follow our normal procedure.
Definitely.
But, you know, break fix is break fix, though. You got to get it done.
It depends. If you've got like, you know, a SLA that you have to keep, then definitely fix it any way you can just to keep the SLA and, you know, lessen the impact on the customer, definitely.
Yeah,
you know, it's something that's, you know, so this is different in a data center or in an ISP or inside of an enterprise company, right? Just depends on, you know, what the repercussions or what the impact of the outage is, how fast can you fix it, and, you know, are you creating any potential trouble going into the future? So it's a complicated, there is a, it's a simple question with many answers.
For sure. So moving right along, I recertified my CCNP last week.
Yay, I think congratulations. It was
like, yay! And I was thinking, man, I'm adulting like a mother today. I was just like, I just felt all grown up because I actually didn't have to do it yet. You know, I still had 8 months before I needed to do it, but I was saving myself some trouble. up ahead, you know, because they're redoing the Cisco stuff, and I didn't want to like have to fart with it. This
You're thing. Just being lazy. You're not a Baltic.
I was doing future Greg a big old favor, is what I was doing. But it did. It made me feel responsible. Oh, when was the last time you took like a certification test or something? Something like into that, you know, where you had to like study and do a thing.
So, when I had to study and do a thing, I don't know, it feels like I constantly study because of, you know, not just recertifications, but everything. But like, I don't even remember. So, I don't have my Microtik certifications renewed just because I haven't had time.
Yeah.
But like those are just, you know, just click and finish. Those are, at least for me, after recertifying like 3 times at this point, I don't have to study for the Microtik stuff anymore. But there's just no time, and I'm not planning on training due to time constraints anytime soon either. So I just didn't renew my other certificates. Well, I don't remember what was the last time I actually had to do like a serious exam that I've left to study for.
But you know what? The Cisco stuff reminds me kind of school, sort of, in that it's a lot of information that you just need to memorize, and then a week later it's all gone. You know, like what are the timers for VRRP and HSRP? You know, and the, like the default timers.
Honestly, this is why I think the Microtik exams are much more relevant to the real world than the Cisco exams.
It feels like more hands-on, for sure.
Like, nobody needs to remember this stuff off the top of their head. We all have internet. This is why it's for. If I had to remember every single tiny detail about every single field or technology that I use, you know, that's just not possible.
One of the questions I got was on VRRP, you know, it uses a specialized MAC address, and then it changes the last 2 digits to match like the VRRP group, and I had to remember what that MAC address was.
Oh,
and it's like, why do I need to know this when I can Google it in quite literally 4 seconds and have the answer show up, you know, for the very first. So it's just, I don't know, man, it's just tons and tons and tons of useless facts that they require you to remember, and it's just, I don't know, you know, it's bittersweet, right? Because if you're actually studying for this stuff to learn it, the Cisco stuff really is good. There's a lot of really good fundamental information, and they tell you why you're doing things, not just what the things are, not just what the knobs are, but when you would generally turn them, right? So it's great for that. But when you're, because I've recertified, I was doing the math, I think I've recertified 6 times on my CCMP, and at this point, all the material they're covering, I've learned it. So it's really just memorization of inane, asinine facts now, or what feels like that. And just, I mean, they're occasionally working in new stuff. So me recertifying early helped me avoid some of that for a little bit, because they're like making you know how to use their wireless LAN controller now. You have to have some actually in-depth information on their wireless LAN controller, which I've only used it once, and I used it for 6 months while I was removing it from a site. Just long enough to it was at the Grizzlies, the FedEx forum. They had a Cisco infrastructure with a Cisco controller, and so I operated that while I was transitioning to the UniFi stuff, and then that went the way of the dodo, you know. So it's just, it's like, it's stuff that I may not ever really use, and I required to know in-depth information, where I think, I don't know, Cisco's CCMP, the routing switch track, never used to have like really very much at all on wireless. And I think now if you're going to be a network engineer, you've got to know wireless stuff. You know, it's an important part of your job. So I think there should be some stuff in there. But forcing people to use a product that if they're not using it in their infrastructure is really complicated to get access to for you to learn on. I don't know. Just kind of, I hate that.
I don't know. My experience with Cisco certifications recently has been just complete degradation of what it means to have a Cisco cert. So here in Slovakia, Cisco is pushing a lot, or making a lot of deals with schools and pushing a lot of Cisco academies. So basically, if you fire up a job posting for a network administrator, all of them will have CCNAs, some of them will have CCNP, but it really means nothing. They have so degraded the value of that certification so much here in this market that I just skip it at this point. CCNA means nothing for me anymore. CCNP means nothing for me anymore. You have high school kids coming out with CCNA certs.
Wow.
And I don't mean like one kid who was good enough to pass it. You have entire classes of high school kids coming out with CCNA certs.
That's crazy.
And they know zero.
Right. They have zero experience utilizing it.
So here in Slovakia, in our market, those certifications no longer mean anything, which is super sad, which is a horrible thing. And, you know, it used to be that I saw someone with CCNA, CCNP on their resume, and I would know, you know, oh, yeah, that's great. I know this guy is better than there is a much higher probability of this guy's being better than somebody who doesn't have it. Today, I just skip it because it's a pointless part of the resume that, you know, everybody now has on their resume.
That's how I feel about college education now, for the most part. If it's on somebody's resume, it doesn't really mean that much to me anymore.
No, tell me about it. In Slovakia, 60% of the population has a college degree. It means nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's just, I don't know. It's I guess it's more a measure of your capacity to learn and execute stuff on a test, right? As opposed to... Well, I mean, and also, I guess it shows
Not here in Slovakia. It's different. Here in Slovakia, basically, schools get... So, all education in Slovakia is free, which means it's crap.
Really?
Education is free. Yeah, all education is free in Slovakia. Wow. You want to go to the college, it's completely free. You get a college degree. But that means that the entire educational system is built around, you know, the more students a school... basically like finishes education at the school, the more money the school gets.
Gotcha. So they're incentivized to have more
imagine, schools are incentivized to have more students and to have more passing students, and it has gotten to a ridiculous point,
right,
that now you have like, this is of course not officially, this is illegal, right, but everybody does it, so you actually have like quotas on the professors where they cannot fail more than a certain number of students because it's just not economical for the school. And, you know, we have, I know many cases where, you know, you have like big exams in like year 4 of college and a professor comes into to the exam room and he says like, okay, this exam everybody passes because we failed, can't fail anyone. And he's like, what's the point then?
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's the ridiculousness of the Slovakian school system.
I mean, does that hurt Slovakian kids that are trying to gain employment in other countries and stuff like that?
I don't think so. Not in other countries. It's just here everybody knows that, you know, college degrees mean nothing anymore. Gotcha.
So if they get the college degree in Slovakia and then they book it somewhere else, those people aren't going to know that maybe the quality of their education isn't.
They wouldn't know. Yeah, you can have a doctorate from Slovakia, which means crap, but you know, you're a doctorate, so like, yeah, big deal if you go out somewhere else.
Well, I mean, what if you're trying to be an MD, like a medical doctor?
That is a little bit different because MDs, so how it works here, I don't know, I actually don't know how that works in the US, but here when you are trying to be an MD, when you get out of school, you have like 6 years of practice you need to do under a different practicing MD where you are not considered like a full grade MD. You cannot do anything individually. Right. You always have to be watched over by somebody. So there is a 6 year period when you go out of school to actually be able to practice MD solo.
But it's still free to become a medical doctor.
Oh, yeah. It's free.
Man, that's crazy. Are there people that are just career students that just basically stay in college their entire life?
There are. Yeah, there are so many. Not entire life. So, like, to be fully exact, the first 6 years of college are free. If you stay in college for longer than 6 years, you pay some token sum to stay a student.
That would actually be kind of cool. I've thought a lot of times, like, I would like to take, like, one college class. Like, you know, like, I've wanted to take, and while I'm not a big fan of the medium, improv, like some improv class, some like improvisational comedy classes. It's supposedly really good for public speaking, thinking on your toes, you know, and just kind of out of the box thinking, stuff like that, you know? because you're basically pulling stuff out of your butt as fast as you possibly can and reacting to other people. And I generally am not a fan of that form of comedy. I mean, I love comedy, but not generally that. But I just thought it would be really cool to grab one of those courses.
So, stuff like that,
if you could just pick and choose and grab stuff, that would be neat.
Yeah, that doesn't work like it here. You either are a student or you aren't a student. Oh, so if you're a student, you have to participate in all the classes of the college.
Oh, well. It's not a perfect system.
Oh,
it was so close.
It's not, I don't know. What's worse than disastrous?
I have no idea, man.
Our educational system is just horrible. Completely disastrous.
That sucks, man. Just move over here to the US. You know you want to.
Oh, yeah, well, you have some high walls that, you know, I'm just not physically capable of getting over those.
Oh, so. Come on, man.
I can't climb that high.
Your English is good enough. I think they'll let you slide through.
Right.
So recently in my lab here at home, you could probably hear it buzzing, my HP DL380G6, I was trying to load ESX 6.7 on it, and my CPUs are too old. So it took me a hot minute, but I found a Dell version of 6.5, which is really just the regular 6.5, but they add some extra Dell drivers, so you could just pull it right off a Dell site. I was, man, VMware does not want to make it easy for you to grab old versions of ESXi off their site.
Oh, yeah.
So I was really glad to find those Dell ones right off the Dell site, so they're nice and clean and check out and everything, and they loaded up fine. But I was running Proxmox, and I was happy with it. I've just started trying to lab a lot more stuff. So I've been trying to like get some ExtremeOS stuff, and I saw it looks like they let you pull VMs for free to like run their. You would probably know more about this, about emulating stuff, even though you're going to start doing actual physical hardware. Some stuff I think it would be easier for me to just, you know, get virtual of or whatever. But it seemed like there's a lot more stuff that's just out there off the shelf that I can just throw on and fire up on ESXi as opposed to Proxmox. It looks like everything on Proxmox, you got to work for it. You know, it seems like everybody's really just making OVAs or whatever for ESXi. So they've got lots of little virtual machines you can just download and crank on for that. So I was thinking, you know what, I'm just going to save myself the trouble. I really threw Proxmox in my lab, so I would just familiarize myself with it. And I like it, and it's nice to use. So I guess I got out of it what I wanted. It's going to be easier for me in the future, I think, to do ESXi. So I'm gonna do that. What's your experience there? Are you guys mostly Proxmox doing any ESXi these days?
So yeah, we do ESXi because of vSAN. Like, I've maintained quite a few clusters in my previous job experiences, from Hyper-V, you know, Microsoft clusters, through VMware clusters. I haven't maintained a Proxmox cluster yet, but we always run VMware stack, you know, ESXi plus vCenter, the vSphere stack, because it's just so much easier. It is easier at the cost of licensing. The licenses are not cheap, but vSAN is magic. It just works. Whereas I feel like every time I have to spin up distributed redundant storage in any other technology, it's just always such a fight, and you always spend ungodly amount of hours making it perform right. There is always performance issues, then it crashes, and Miller could probably talk to us about his issues.
Yeah, like doing those Ceph clusters or whatever, and it seems like. Once you get it up and, I mean, it seems like you almost have to sacrifice a goat and a chicken to get it up and running. Oh, yeah. But then 3 months down the line, some weird anomaly is going to crop up and bite you in the butt. Well, then you got to fix that.
Like maintaining ZFS pools and Ceph clusters, it's, you know, yeah, you get it running and then suddenly you find out, oh, it's not performing right. Or, you know, like I said, half a year in it, something breaks and it's just ridiculous. Whereas with vSAN, it's just you click a couple of buttons and it works for years.
Right. And so vSAN is the idea is you can have like a bunch of, so let's roll back for people that aren't familiar really quick, the Cliffs Notes version, right? So VMware is a hypervisor, ESXi, the installable version.
So to be exact, yeah, VMware is a company.
Yeah. But they, oh, yeah, because they have multiple products under their line, right?
Yes.
So ESXi is the hypervisor that you can install. And vCenter is the unifying, what do you call that? The controller? No, it's not a controller. What do you call it? Just it's an interface where
it's the management plane. Yeah, it's a management appliance for your ESXi cluster.
I'm trying not to say single pane of glass because I hate that phrase, but ultimately that's what it is, right? So you can manage all of those servers by going to one administrative interface.
Servers, clusters, data centers, everything.
All right, and so vSAN is, and I'm sure I'm going to say it wrong, but like all of your ESXi hosts, which are the physical machines, you can load them up with hard drives and then run vSAN, and it basically makes distributed storage across all of them, right?
So it's what they call hyper-converged infrastructure. So it used to be, the trend used to be years ago that you would run your compute and your storage separately.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so your storage would be some highly available storage appliance or something you built that exposes the block storage to your compute servers, but it's separate. So each compute server would have typically iSCSI or fiber channel connections to your SANs storage area network, and your SANs would expose that block storage. And so the point there is you can migrate your virtual machines around your compute without storage being affected. As you can imagine, if I want to migrate a virtual machine from one host to another, and if that virtual machine is a couple of terabytes of data, you know, that migration is just not going to happen. So if the storage is separated from your compute, then you can migrate around and storage is always connected to all of the compute nodes. So the trend recently has shifted to what's called hyperconverged, where storage is again back together with compute, but you use, here is the magic word, software-defined storage, right? So some software magic to automatically replicate and move the storage around the cluster and keep it highly available in multiple places around the cluster. And you can still decouple storage from compute, but the software magic keeps it connected across the VMs. So we can technically run a VM on a compute of a different server than the storage of the VM is on. And so vSAN is VMware's answer to that software-defined storage magic, right? So how it works is, let's say you have 10 servers and you just push 5 hard drives into each of those 10 servers, then you click a few buttons, and suddenly, all of those storages you can't see it anymore in the individual hypervisors. It just shows up as a storage pool in your cluster. And vSAN takes care automatically of the replication, of high availability, of migration, of load balancing, and everything else, you know, that your block storage across the pool of available storage resources. I hope that's
not. So the idea is
too abstract.
You don't have to like be a dedicated SAN engineer where you've got this big SAN and you're the smart guy that knows how to operate it and do all the knob turning and stuff like that. Now you can just get a bunch of boxes that you're going to run your VMs on and load them up with hard drives, and not only will they be VM hosts, right, to host the VMware, but they're also the storage piece, right? So it's kind of magic.
The magic is, yeah, that you don't need to care about it. You don't need to maintain RAID. You don't need to maintain everything. It does automatic tiering. It does automatic caching. It's magic.
Yeah, I remember like 15 years ago talking to my friend and be like, why? Because we were just starting to do virtualization at the company we were working for. I was like, why can't they just do this? I was like, I don't know. I mean, it was all brand new, and I was just thinking, that makes so much sense. Why can't they just make this stuff easy? Why do you have to make everything so damn complicated? And now they've done it for a price.
Yeah, for a hefty price. Like vSAN there is a hefty price to pay for vSAN licensing, but I feel it's cheaper than a dedicated storage engineer. So, you know, and it's cheaper than, at least in my view, It's much cheaper even in the long term than fighting with Ceph or ZFS pools and everything, you know. So you don't have to have a person, you don't have to worry about it breaking, you don't have to worry about keeping that the knowledge in the company if the person decides to leave.
Right.
You know, you have licensing, it works, and you know, if you always have VMware support should something break. And yeah, in reality, you know, this is a picture perfect world, which of course reality is different, and I'm not saying this is some, you know, magical it never breaks and it always works technology. I think nothing is, but
yeah.
I like that much better than, you know, doing everything yourself.
For sure, man. I'm on board. I've sold my soul to the devil as well, so it's good. Oh man. Let's move on to some MikroTik stuff. It wouldn't be a Brothers Wisp podcast if I didn't push my MikroTik agenda onto people. So there was some interesting news. RouterOS version 7.0 beta 5 came out.
Oh, yeah.
And they had two things that were of particular interest to me. One is VXLAN support and VRRP connection tracking data replication, which I find to be juicy as well. So
yeah,
let me take a swing at it, and you tell me all the things I'm saying wrong. So VRRP is Virtual Router Redundancy Protocol. It's the first hop redundancy protocol. So the idea being you can have two routers and say a switch connected to those two routers that share the same segment, the same layer two network, and then all of your hosts can point their default gateways to VRRP that has kind of a virtual IP that swings back and forth, right? It's if you lose one gateway, the other one will take over that IP, and your host will be none the wiser, and they'll just continue to forward traffic, right?
Straight out of the CCNP lesson books.
Yeah, yeah, I just went over all this crap. But one thing it doesn't do is, so whenever all those things kick over in a MikroTik, whenever the, say, the backup, what is it? The passive one takes over. I can't remember what the nomenclature is. It's like active, yes. Standby, passive, whatever.
Master and slave.
There you go, master and slave. So whenever the slave takes over, he doesn't know about any of the NATing that's happened, right? So all those connections are going to break, and then he'll have to start the NATing and all that stuff over again, right? So there's no connection information saved about what was, you know, moving through the firewall. He doesn't know about any established connections, even if you aren't doing NATing and things like that, wherein if they start replicating that information, then things will be a lot smoother, right?
So, yeah, definitely. And in an ideal world, you know, the networking stacks of the two hosts communicating would just deal with this, you know, TCP reset, and there you go. But there is still high possibility, you know, there is firewalls involved, there might be some mangle rules involved. And actually, this is a really good question, which we don't have answer to. If connection tracking is replicated, will also be packet marks and connection marks be replicated?
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't even think that far down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, because if you think about it, you know, mangle relies on those heavily. And if those are not replicated, then your mangle rules will not work. So who knows? But yeah, the point is, if it's not replicated, things will break, connections will break, you know, and if we can avoid that, then super.
Yeah, let's do it for sure. All right. Are you interested in the VXLAN support?
I haven't yet had a use case where I think VXLAN would be a magical bullet to solve it that I couldn't solve with other technologies. I understand its place. I think, or I am afraid now that many people will, you know, hail VXLAN as a solution to problems which have completely valid different solutions, simply because it's currently kind of a hype technology.
Yeah, current buzzword.
I also think very many people are going to shoot themselves in the foot with VXLAN due to multicast, because VXLAN relies on multicast, and we all know the word multicast, but I bet most people don't actually know how much of an involved technology multicast is. It's not a simple, you know, one button technology that just works. Multicast is a complex set of technologies and protocols and concepts that you have to know to properly implement it, and VXLAN relies on it heavily.
Right.
So
and multicast routing is a little bricked, in router OS right now, right?
Yeah, that's another thing, right? The PIM support in router OS is in a bad spot.
Right, but this is a version 7 feature, and so theoretically, that multicast routing should be fixed whenever they get that written and implemented. One would hope.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So VXLAN, it's transport. It's going to be layer 2 transport, right? So it'll create these VXLAN connections over a routed network. So like Cisco, again, in their infinite wisdom on the new CCNA, is heavily pushing some of their, what did they call it? SDA, Software Defined Access. So they want you to use their DNA center, which is a controller.
Of course they do.
Yeah, a controller that whenever you introduce a new piece of network equipment, it will reach out, provision it. So it does all the, I mean, it's the easy button, right? It does all the magic. The idea being your switches at the edge, they all route. So once they go back into the network, there's no more layer two, it's all routing. So this VXLAN actually creates, like, if I've got a switch here and I've got a switch at Thomas's house and we want to be on the same layer two segment, VXLAN will actually create that layer two tunnel in between this routed network and carry that traffic. And it uses some service. I think Cisco calls it like a map server. And so they'll inform each other of their RLOCs, which is like their routing locator number, and then the VXLAN tunnel and the subnets associated with that. And then that guy acts as like a proxy in between to set up a connection. It kind of sounds like SIP, right? So he accepts the calls and then connects the two clients together and they do all of the communication. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to work in router OS or how well it's going to interoperate with other vendors, right? Who knows yet? I guess it's just initial support. We'll see what it does. It's interesting. I know there's a lot of guys in like the data center world that are keen for it. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's a lot of this comes down to, you know, there has been a emergence of I don't want to say vendors or people, just an immersion of people, whoever you define those people as, pushing as at, you know, basically segregating every single individual endpoint in the network and tunneling it individually, so you have more control over the traffic. So basically, you anytime anything connects to a network, like Greg mentions, it gets tunneled. So there is no more local layer 2, there is no more local communication, everything gets tunneled in an overlay, and the overlay dictates security policies, and it dictates access policies, and it dictates traffic forwarding. And that overlay can be many things. I know Cisco has some proprietary stuff for this as well. There are other vendors that have some proprietary stuff for this as well. You can do this even with VPLS dynamically, you can do this with, I don't know, even L2TP with BCP, right? It's just a layer 2 overlay stretching across a layer 3 network. But yeah, VXLAN is getting really popular at these use cases where you want to basically segregate and tunnel every single individual endpoint from a centralized controller entity that controls traffic flow, access policies, and everything else. So VXLAN is a really good for that use case, and there is a large amount of people pushing those use cases, even in like campus networking, even in you know, access networks that connect individual end users, because it brings benefits. Of course it brings benefits. You have complete control over all the traffic, there is no more local layer 2, you know, it gives you a lot of control, which some use cases require. And we'll see, you know, if this approach and if this technology, how it goes into the future.
For sure, man. All right, so let's see. If you were to go on the internet right now and you Google the word Microtik Chateau, you will find on several vendor sites listings of a new Microtik product called the Chateau series. It's one router to delight them all, it says. I'm sorry, that hit me the weird way, their marketing there. So it's a, again, I, it feels like, at least design wise, aesthetics wise, they're moving in the direction that they did with the audience. I really like the way this thing looks. I think it's very aesthetically pleasing.
I like it,
right?
As well. Yeah, you can see the end consumer product.
Yeah, You wouldn't consider, you're not going to put this in the middle of your network. It is very much kind of an end user router. It looks like they're really focusing on LTE with this guy, right? Isn't that the idea?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
It's got, I think, what was there, like 10 versions of it or something with different kind of LTE So you got a Puma about to attack you back there. Lots of different LTE interfaces with different bands and categories and all kinds of stuff. So I'm not 100% sure what all of them will be. But it's got 5 gig ports, a full-size USB on the back. It's got a couple of built-in antennas. Looks like you got a 2.4 dual-chain antenna, 5 gigahertz dual-chain AC on that guy. It looks like, I mean, it's fairly powerful too. I think 4 core processor, 256 megs of RAM. Looks like it'll be a decent home router.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you can see they're aiming it at basically a 4G, 5G in-home distribution router.
I guess this is more kind of a product for the Latvian telecom project that they've been working on, right?
Yeah, so they definitely announced that they have a partnership with Latvian Telecom, and I am, it's obvious that this came from that partnership. But, you know, if they develop the product and if they know that product is desired by telecoms, then it just makes business sense to sell it everywhere.
Yeah, for sure. It says operating system RouterOS version 7 and above, so it's a 7-only product. And to my understanding, there's not that many features in version 7 yet, so I don't know.
I think version 7 feature wise, the only thing that's not there is the new routing engine.
Well, and I guess you don't really need a full BGP stack for an in-home LTE router.
Yeah, hopefully not.
If it's showing up on people's websites, I mean, that means it's probably somewhat close to distribution, right?
If distributors are receiving this in the newsletter, that means they will be able to order it fairly soon.
Yeah, and the fact that they're putting it up on their website, so.
Yeah.
I don't think I saw anybody on Google showing up from the U.S. with it, but I saw it on, a Latvian distributor and some other people in Europe, so it's at least going to debut there soon. I don't know about over here.
So it's, yeah, it's interesting what the timeline is on this due to this being RouterOS version 7 only. So the timeline on this feels like it's very much a timeline on RouterOS version 7 as well.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I guess it's going to do the TR69 or whatever configuration stuff.
Yeah,
well,
they heavily relied on that in the newsletter. You know, a telecom deploying this will have complete control over it with TR, you know, how much configuration they expose to the end user, you know, with the MikroTik WebFig skins. You know, a telecom can, you wouldn't even know it's a MikroTik, basically, if a telecom skins this through the WebFig skins properly and then, you know, manages their TR. So definitely MikroTik has the feature set at this point to be a extremely powerful end user router, and they have the pricing to be a extremely affordable end user router. So I think it just makes sense for MikroTik from a business perspective to push this onto telecoms and, you know, 4G, 5G distribution in-house. And so yeah, smart business move, MikroTik.
For sure. Cool. Let's see, some other hardware. The Unify USW Flex. I know as soon as I say Unify, you lose interest. Unify USW Flex Mini 5-port managed switch. So it's a tiny 5-port managed switch that you can power via PoE. It looks like they're coming in at like $29. So it's a really cheap. It says it's managed, so it's going to be able to do VLANs and whatnot. It looks like it's gigabit as well. So
you can see all the interest in my face right there. No. I'm being too harsh. Unify has a use case.
I know it does. Yeah. Agreed. Like, you have some kind of, if you just have need for a small Unify additional switch, you could chuck it in there for $29. I mean, that's pretty inexpensive.
Unify just has a use case. It's just not any use case that I can use.
So it's out there. If you guys are interested, there's at least media coverage on. I don't know that they're actually on the market yet. Let's see. What else do we have cooking? Unimus 2.0.0 Beta 1.
Oh, yeah. Finally, it happened.
You guys, mid-flu, you guys are trying to push out this beta, right?
Oh, it's ridiculous. This beta has been such a fight. It started to feel like a unicorn as well at some point.
Do you guys give code names to these things in there?
No, not really. It's just 2.0 beta 1.
All right.
Well, yeah, it was a huge fight. It was 5+ months of development. The last 2 months, the entire team has been pushing crazy hours to get this rolling. And then, yeah, last week we had to close down the office because 5 of our people got the flu. It's flu season,
right?
In Slovakia. Yeah, me included. So, you know, 5 people from our Košice office, which is where we do development and support. And so that's like almost half of our offices here in Košice. And so we had to close down, but yeah, we finally got this beta out. Finally.
Well, thank goodness, man. Well, any particular highlights you want to talk about?
Oh, it's huge. The change log is 150 lines.
Holy cow.
If you read the change log, thank you. Thank you very much. There is multiple super cool new things in 2.0 coming. So there is, of course, the full Slack notifications with a diff, you know, full graphical diffs into Slack. There is scheduling for mass config push. So push presets can now be fully scheduled.
Oh, that's
more
awesome.
Automation power, everything else. There is cron support in the scheduler. So up until now, we just had basically like pre-made schedules, but people were asking for, you know, why can't I do whatever I want? So yeah, now you can. There is cron. There is a tons of improvements to user experience and to the UI user interface. There is just tons of stuff there. And there's like 40 different bug fixes of various bugs issues. And we are, this was a really hard one. For some of our bigger deploys, but only the bigger deploys, I think our biggest deployment right now is at 16,000 devices in Unimus.
Wow.
And they were seeing like each failed or each scheduled run, they were seeing like, you know, 50 to 70 devices fail a scheduled run. So it was like just under 1% of devices in your system would fail on scheduled jobs. And this one has been so tough to track down and to debug. And, you know, when you have a system with 16,000 devices, how do you track down just under 1% of them failing jobs?
So that was every time they ran it, it was probably different devices failing.
Oh yeah, definitely. Every time it was different devices. Of course it was.
No consistency.
And it was completely inconsistent. You know, different numbers of devices failing, and like those devices, they would complete their schedule job, whether that was a config push or backup or whatever, they would complete it eventually, usually right immediately at the second run. You know, mm-hmm. There was a very little chance that a single device would fail twice in a row, which made it very hard to debug, but we found it, we fixed it, it was so much work. But yeah, it's like the change log is huge. There is many new features. If you would like to help us test this, please do. This is a huge release. And the biggest part of it is, so Unimus is now fully distributed. We have added a remote proxy, a remote agent. So now you can have a single server which manages many different, disparate networks through in-network local proxies that run the jobs locally and then push results to a central server, which people have been asking for a long time. So to be 100% completely precise, this is coming in 2.0.0 beta 2, but by the time people are listening to this, it should already be out.
Baller, so, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Oof.
If you want to help us test, we would really appreciate that. This, like, the 2.0 code branch, about 70% of Unimus was rewritten.
That's
so crazy. This is more honestly, this is more a rewrite than it is a upgrade.
That's crazy. How long is it going to take you to completely rewrite for version 3?
I hope we don't have to. I hope we don't have to.
You love thinking about stuff like that, right?
Oh, I hope we don't have
I hope you don't have to either, bud.
to. Oh yeah, maybe one last thing. And thanks to Justin Miller for this. We also added Observium and PRTG importers.
Oh, nice.
And so Justin helped with the Observium importer part. And so yeah, it hopefully makes it easier for people to adopt into the network as
Is that
well.
a one-time or is it like run on a schedule?
Oh, that's up to you how we configure
Oh,
it.
that's awesome. That's cool. So as you add stuff to Observium, it could be picked up and automatically thrown into Unimus.
Well, like that's the point of Unimus, right? It should be extremely simple and extremely easy and fast to use. So like this is why we have these NMS importers, or this is why we have network scan, right? The point is every time you're deploying a network in your device, you don't want to add it into five systems. What's the point of that? It's just duplicate jobs. So if Unimus can adopt those devices out of your monitoring system, then you just add those devices into your monitoring and Unimus will pick it up automatically. And due to other discovery mechanisms, you don't have to tell Unimus what vendor it is, what type it is, what credentials, ports, all of that is automatically discovered by Unimus. So basically, it's just you add it to your monitoring and Unimus will completely automatically manage and do everything it needs with the device.
Yeah, somebody the other day was asking what people thought about Unimus, and I said, I love it. You install it and then you just forget about it.
That's not how you are
That is
supposed to use it.
100% how you're supposed to use it, because if, like you're saying, if it's up, if it's grabbing all your devices, it will take care of itself and then it sends you notifications of, hey, I completed all these things. I was a good boy today.
So,
I did all of my homework. And so I don't
for
have
me,
to
it's
jack with it. I love that.
for me, it's different, actually. Honestly, like now, Unimus, and I know it's my own software, but it has taken over so much of my workflow in networking. Like, usually when you do stuff in a network, it's not on a single device. Like, whether that be, updating firewall rules or adding access to IPs or, messing with VLANs, many times it is on a single device, but a lot of times it's not, and like the config search for me has been I couldn't live without it anymore. Am I deploying an SSID? Okay, I type a couple words, check how the SSID is configured on a different device, and just copy it, right? Am I deploying some firewall rules? All right, well, since I'm already messing with firewalls, let me check for consistency of that firewall rule across the network. Type in a couple words into config search, and there you go, I have it, right? Am I deploying a VLAN? All right, let's check where that VLAN is, how it's configured, type in a couple words into config search. There you have it, right? Same with the, like I said, the firewall address list deployments. I just have config push presets that I just push to devices. I don't configure stuff manually anymore. It's,
So what you're
yeah.
saying is it's helping you be lazy.
Oh yeah,
yeah
definitely. It's automation. It's time savings.
I
It's
can get
what
on
it's
board with
for.
that. I can get on board with that, but
So like I said, Unimus has taken so much of my workflow in networking, it's ridiculous.
I know I hate trying to describe it because I always feel like I'm not doing it justice, and I think everybody uses it just a little bit differently, right? So
Oh
the way
yeah.
I describe
That's
it may not, like completely fit the Lego brick spot that somebody else has, but they can absolutely use it in a different way and completely different from me and will be extremely successful and happy with it. So
That's the thing. We recently talked to some of our customers, and we found that just like we contacted, I think, like 12 people, and we found that like just about each of them had a different use case that they used Unimus for. Somebody was only interested in compliance, in config change notifications. Others had, 500 CPEs, which they were updating RouterOS on through Unimus. Others used it for, I constantly search for frequencies, when I do frequency management, config search for frequencies, just type in the frequency number, it shows me all my APs that are running on that frequency and stuff like that. So it's yeah, everybody has a very different use case, and we were a little bit surprised actually that, you know, many times people don't even know we have some features in Udemy which they could use because they are using it just for their singular use case, which, well, it just tells us that we need to message better on what Udemy even can do.
How do you think you'd go about doing that? Maybe doing blog posts?
I don't know. Yeah, we want to start doing much more content, blog posts, how-tos, videos, you know, stuff like that, which we hope it will help. And also, we don't know, if somebody has ideas how to, you know, improve the UI of Unimus, how to improve feature visibility, or, you know, if you are using Unimus only for backups and you never knew we had config push, which is a crazy powerful feature. If you have an idea of why you haven't used it or why, we would love to hear it.
You know, I remember you did a presentation at some point in the last few years where you talked about how you did this massive automated push system for some place, but it was very secret and you couldn't tell. And then right when you got to the meat and potatoes where how it actually worked, you had to stop. And so I think people would be, yeah. I get it. Like in your brain, you've got this little voice that says, I can't do this because it's my product and I feel like I'm pushing my crack on people. But I think if you did a presentation showing Unimus do mass configuration pushes to stuff, or, you know, all of the things we're talking about where, you know, you have this mass thing that goes out and looks and does some menial task that would take somebody a million years, but it automates something for it. I think people would love seeing how Unimus can do that stuff.
So I've thought about it, but I don't think Microtik, for example, for MUMS, I don't think Microtik would approve a presentation based solely on a single product.
No, you're not doing it based on a product. You're saying mass automation. And it just happens be using Unimus. And you show all these people really valid use cases and how they would go about doing it. I think that's okay. I really do. Because I've seen other vendors do stuff where they're using their product and it's in a novel way that I've never thought of before. And I didn't feel like I was, you know, getting a hard sell.
So this is something, it's not really a secret. What we want to do and what I think will be great when we have it for this is we want to make like a marketplace, and I don't mean paid, just like a free marketplace for config push presets.
Oh, that would be awesome.
So you can just like click a button to get an exported like a really long string of your mass config push preset. You can version it and you can publish it online for others to download. Or for example, you get a new piece of gear, right? You buy some, I don't know, Converse switch that you never configured, and you would go there, you would select Conver, type in VLAN, and it would show you all the VLAN config push presets that people have shared that work with Unimus, and you click a single button and it would import the chosen preset to your Unimus instance. And so we want to do something like that. We want to build a platform for people to share configuration snippets, to share automation snippets and stuff like that. But it would be super simple, you know, it's not something that takes any effort. So you click a button, it's in your system, or you want to share something, you click a button and it's shareable and usable by others. But it just takes time. Yeah. It takes a lot of time to build stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure, man. I get it. I just know that's like with NetXMS. Like, I don't want to reinvent the wheel every time. I don't want to beat that horse because, I mean, there's hardly anything left of it from me beating and harping on this. But I would love a marketplace where I could just go and then grab default basic stuff, you know, that just does the normal things, and I can just be up and running in no time flat, you know, not have to reinvent the wheel every time I want to do that stuff. Plus, I mean, I've written a lot of custom stuff for Cacti that there were no templates for, and if I could just put that back up in the community and somebody else could grab this weird thing that I made, I mean, that would be awesome. I would be happy to do that. I wouldn't have a problem.
So yeah, I mean, once we have that in place, I think, you know, I can actually go like on stage and do a presentation, not on Unimus, but yeah, here's some really useful automation presets that, of course, I am using Unimus for distribution, for the mass config push into the network, but really it's about the automation stuff. It's about the scripts. It's about the presets. And, you know, those are available on our marketplace.
Well, until you have a marketplace, you could put it up on a public GitHub repository.
Yeah, definitely.
You know what I mean? So you could still do that presentation. I'm just saying, you keep talking yourself out of it. I think you could at least float the idea to Microtik, and you know, his name just fell right out of my head. The guy that's in charge of the mums and stuff now, but you know, he would just say yay or nay
Normans?
On it, you know. Caspers?
Do you mean,
is that it?
I don't know. Isn't Normans in charge of mums?
Oh, like, the presentation stuff. I always end up talking to Caspers.
Huh,
at least on the US ones. I don't know. Maybe
who knows?
Maybe they divide the regions or something.
Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, it's like, so for example, even for like this year, I am doing an IPsec presentation again. I think we mentioned that in one of the last podcasts, just to make my life easier. I will already be using Unimus to, because I want to, so this will be the first time I will be doing a live demo on stage, so things will go horribly wrong. I try to avoid those because they always go horribly wrong.
I know
wrong.
They
But my plan to avoid having them go horribly wrong is to have everything preset in Unimus config push presets, and then I just put, you know, basically for each test topology that I'm going to be testing and changing, it will all be just Unimus presets. So it will all be prepared in presets, and I will just be, you know, pressing run in Unimus to deploy all of those configurations for the live demo. So I'm hoping that will mitigate the live demo curse.
That's clever.
And yeah.
I mean, good luck with that. I mean, see if you can beat fate. I don't think it's possible, but I don't know if you've watched The Witcher, but fate's going to do what fate's going to do.
Yeah, we'll see.
That's awesome, man. All right, dude.
Yeah, I think the only lesson from Witcher is don't you know, promise your kids away. I think that's...
Yeah, what is it, like rule of surprise or something? Don't go for that.
I'm sure I will get flamed for this, but The Witcher TV series was horrible. It was so bad.
You can suck it. Now, I enjoyed it.
It was
But you know
bad.
What? I was thinking about it. Maybe I was just so thirsty for something new and different kind of in that genre.
I think that's...
That maybe that's why I enjoyed it. But I did enjoy
it. No, it was bad.
I also watched it while I was building LinkedIn courses. So I was like building a course with that on kind of on my second screen. So it wasn't like I was just dedicated.
So you weren't even watching it.
Well, yeah. I was... You know,
it was just noise on the
stuff
screen.
Would happen. Oh man, I was watching it more than I was The Mandalorian. I had The Mandalorian doing the same thing, and
Mandalorian
was
not bad actually.
50% of what was going on in there, because
I liked Mandalorian. There were some stupid parts of
the Mandalorian
as well.
Well, there were just some bits that got slow, you know.
Not even slow, but I don't know, what are Hollywood writers doing these days? It's like some writing decisions in those episodes, and Witcher specifically, you know, there was stuff happening, and I don't mean the broader, bigger storyline. I mean the individual little things in episodes that just made zero sense, that just happened for no reason and had no place to even be there or to happen. And it was similar to a Mandalorian in a few bits, in a very few bits, that, you know, the writing... Were just, what were they thinking? But let's just skip the rest of the rant.
All right, man, we're at like an hour and 20. You got anything profound you need to drop on these people?
There have been no profound realizations in my life in the last 2 weeks.
Gotcha. You're just trying to not have the flu for a minute, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to get out of the flu right now.
All right, well, you claw your way out, and I guess if people want to find you out on the internet, how are they going to do that?
As usual, just Google for me. You'll find me everywhere. And there's always unimus.net. There is a live chat. Feel free to ask.
There you go. No ASCII art. Doesn't work. Formatting gets all messed up.
Yeah, we tried. Nope.
All right. If you want to find me, it's greg@gregshole.com is the email address, or you can go to gregshole.com. I just recently found out that all of my contact form was going to spam because I get a copious amount of spam there, so that contact form's actually functioning again. Thank goodness.
So for the last year,
oh man,
and
it's probably been
contacts.
A while, because it's been really quiet, and I was just like, oh, I guess people are, you know, they're doing other things. No, it's not. As soon as I fixed it, yeah, it started really. Yeah,
no,
so.
It was just Greg ignoring all of you.
Oh, it was nice quiet respite for a little minute there. Also, if you want to get into the Slack, where a lot of this content. I came from a lot of the good discussion, the discourse. It's always friendly discourse in there, and I've never seen anybody get too hot and bothered. We do have a politics and religion section, but people, I mean, they're staying civil, so it's good.
Yeah, considering the Slack is now at like 120 people, I'm really surprised it's been very civil.
Yeah, extremely civil. Yeah, it's unprecedented on the internet. It will never happen again.
Thank you, everyone. That's a credit to our patrons in the Slack.
Yeah, it's bananas. These guys are awesome. So much good sharing of information. Like, I quite literally can't answer anybody's question anymore because three people have already done it for me. So it's impossible. It's so much good information, and I don't want that to daunt people that are lurkers in there. I think there's so much benefit. I saw somebody say, hey, I finally contributed something the other day. I was thinking, man, you guys contribute more than you think you are. So just get in there, share your experiences, your information. It's great. And you can get into that.
Or just lurk and read.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I want to encourage people. They say, if you're comfortable, you're not growing. So get in there and get a little uncomfortable. It's going to be good for you. Make some connections, get your voice heard, get a shout out on this thing. But patreon.com/thebrotherswisp, throw us a couple bones, I'll send you a Slack invite. Any questions, comments, please keep them coming. If there's anything in particular you want us to cover, let's do that. I think Wisp America is going to come up. I think I might actually go. I'm trying to make Mikey get me a ticket. If he can get me one of those golden Willy Wonka tickets, I'm going to go up there for at least a couple days and hang out, see everybody, talk to some of the vendors. But yeah, I digress. Going back, questions, comments, anything you guys want to hear about, let us know. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.